Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Patrick and get a free phone. Go to charitymobile.com.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Hello. Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show. My number is 888-914-9149. Chances are you already know that if you're a regular. 888-914-9149.
Patrick?
Yeah.
You offer...
Right out of the gate.
Right out of the gate. I just can't stop thinking about this life hack that you just... threw at me, and it's a game changer, and I think you should share it with everybody. Life hacks with Patrick Madrid.
Well, there were two. We talked about two just before the program. You want both? You want me to repeat both?
I want that McDonald's one. Is that it's you a 1-2 punch.
Okay, this is true, and trust me on... Don't you hate it when you go to McDonald's and
you're
after
ordering
the fries,
your adult Happy Meal.
Mildly depressed Happy Meal. Yeah, so, I mean, yay for McDonald's. Nothing negative to say there, but it happens that if the French fries have been sitting in the basket for a while, they get wilted, they get cold. They're not like really delicious the way they are when they're freshly cooked. Am I right or am I right?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay. So here's the life hack. And I don't know where I picked this up, but I picked it up years ago. And let me tell you, it works like a charm. So pull your chairs a little closer to the radio, everybody, because you're going to like this. What you do is when you go through the drive-thru, you order your fries with no salt. This is not a joke. Order your fries with no salt because then they have to make them fresh. There's a fresh batch boiling away in that hot oil for you. Then when they hand you your food, and these fries are absolutely fresh right out of the fryer, then ask for a packet of salt. Then you salt your fries, and they are crisp and delicious and absolutely fresh out of the fryer. And it really works.
I love it. So Ask for this, ask for the fries with no salt, and then at the window, ask for some packets
ask for
of salt.
And you know, every time I do that, I'm always waiting for the person at the window to look at me funny, like, I thought you didn't want salt. And they it just goes right over their heads. They don't even blink. So not that it would be an issue, but... It is. It works like a charm. And if you want crisp, delicious, freshly cooked fries, probably not very heart healthy, but in moderation.
Yeah, we didn't say this was a health hack.
No,
this is a life hack.
Yeah, and it will change your life if you like McDonald's French fries. And I don't know too many people who don't. So try it, and you'll always get fresh fries.
I will do that forever now. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that.
So here's the other hack, which was not quite as impressive to you, but it really does work too. So if you have a Yeti cup or a thermos cup and you're going to keep, let's say, hot coffee, you want it to stay hot. It's like I start every morning when I roll into the studio, I've got a cup of coffee in my hand and it's in a Yeti cup. And those are, you know, like thermos. So my life hack here is I just simply, before I pour the coffee into it, I pour steaming hot water out of the tap into the Yeti cup and put the lid on and let it sit there for 5 minutes or so and get really, really hot, get the metal hot. Then I pour the water out, pour the coffee in, and that coffee will stay hot forever. And it really does work because I hate reheating my coffee. So there you have it. And I know that was less spectacular than the first one.
It is because I drink my coffee so fast. It doesn't have a chance to get cold.
Yeah. Lucky you. I'm too busy talking.
That's right. I'm sipping my coffee, watching you work.
Well, it's a good thing to have some of these hacks on hand. And here's a hack. If you want to be on the program, call me at 888-914-9149, 888-914-9149. A few things in the news I thought I would share with you. First of all, I think it's impressive. This is from NASA, analysis of data obtained over the last 2 weeks by the DART mission team shows that an impact with Dimorphos has successfully altered the asteroid's orbit by 32 minutes, marking the first time humans have changed the orbit of a celestial object in space. Now, that may not seem like a lot, but think about that for a minute. For all the years of human history, from the time of Adam and Eve, And who knows how long ago that was. Human beings, in recent years, we've been able to land on other planets. We landed on the moon. We've sent probes to Mars and to Venus. I mean, that's big news in itself. But never have we been able to actually alter the course of a heavenly body, a celestial object, as NASA puts it. But we did it by, you know the movies where, like, there's an inbound asteroid, and Morgan Freeman, when he's not playing God, he's playing the president, and he's rallying everybody to send a missile up to the asteroid and knock it off its course.
Yeah, you've got to send Bruce Willis to the asteroid.
Yeah,
right.
With a bunch of misfit oil rig guys they're not astronauts. They're like oil rig guys.
Don't think too hard about it.
Yeah. They figure, well, these guys at least know how to do oil rig stuff. So let's put them in spacesuits and send them up in a sophisticated space shuttle. Yeah, that movie. Well, we actually did it this time. And it was relatively small asteroid. And they crashed this little device into it, this rocket. And it changed the orbit of this asteroid. So I suppose what that means is, going forward, is we now know how to do this kind of thing. And I guess they'll have to perfect it so that it will be done on a larger scale if Morgan Freeman comes out of retirement and never becomes president. And if we ever have an inbound asteroid that could destroy the Earth. That's my takeaway from that story. Here's another one. Totally different. This is courtesy of GB News. In the UK, a vegan who failed to deal with a mouse infestation in her home, claiming that taking action against the mice would go against her ethical beliefs, has been fined by a court. District counsel said that 73-year-old Margaret Manzoni of Clacton Road, St. Osyth in Essex, considered the mice her pets. She said they would not go to her neighbors because she looked after them. I bet they didn't, because if she was feeding them, they had it made in the shade. Look at this lady. She's not putting out traps. She's putting out food for us. After hearing at Colchester Magistrates Court this month, the lady said that while the court respected her beliefs as an ethical vegan, others saw mice as vermin. The court said the impact of the infestation on neighbors meant inaction was not appropriate. Manzoni admitted during the hearing in October 6th to be exact, to charges of failing to comply with the notice under the Environmental Protection Act. And this act controls the prevention of damage by pests. She was fined £1,500, and the court awarded the council cost of about £2,500 and imposing a victim surcharge of £150. And by the way, Cyrus, if you're planning to go to England anytime soon, now's the time to go, because the pound has dropped so low that it's not quite even with the dollar, but it's getting there. I think it's like $1.10 per pound.
Yeah, and that's one of my jobs, is to convert that stuff for you, which I didn't do.
Which you didn't do.
I didn't do. So that 15,000 pounds comes out to about
1,500 pounds.
Yeah. Oh, 1,500. Oh, 1,500.
Right.
Let me erase that zero. That comes out to $1,654.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, every time I would go to England in the past, you would get brutalized by trying to buy things with the exchange rate being so high. But now... Of course, now with the value of the pound decreasing so much, and it's getting really close to the dollar, I think the dollar now is more than the euro, or at least we're even, Steven. But now they're having all these energy crisis problems, and a lot of businesses are closing up because they can't afford a $15,000 a month electric bill. You know, it was $800 in the summer, and now it's like $15,000 in some cases. So it's crazy. So there's your offset. But anyway, what I found interesting about this story is that she fought this in court on the basis of her ethical beliefs, saying that she should be able to feed the mice. Now, she's a vegan, so as I understand it, she's something more than a vegetarian. A vegetarian, for whatever health reasons or diet reasons, goes with just vegetables. But vegans have a commitment to the idea of not eating animals of any kind. And I can respect that. I have nothing against that. St. John the Baptist, he ate locusts and wild honey. He didn't eat meat. So we have even a biblical example of that. But there's nothing wrong with eating meat as such. But I can respect somebody who says, I just don't want to eat animals. I just don't want to harm animals. I can respect that. There's nothing inherently wrong with that. But it was this defense that didn't succeed in the court that feeding these mice and not controlling the mice as pests was on the basis of her ethical beliefs. And I think that's where this interesting and oddball story may have a little bit of value. And that is, you know, there are times where you're not obliged to do something that would violate your ethical beliefs, even if somebody might want you to do that. But you can still be considerate of other people. And it seemed like this was an example of that, where you could be considerate of your neighbors who don't want mice running around. So if you control the mice, I don't know, how would you do that without killing the mice? You know, glue strips, they work wonders, but the animal's never going to get off that glue strip. And traps, of course, ugh, you know, when you think about that. So it is a dilemma for her, but the court settled that issue. Now, on the other side of the world, in an unrelated but kind of interesting tie-in story, very sad, the president of the Mexican Hunting Federation died after being charged by a buffalo weighing more than 1,000 kilos. He shot at it. He was at a distance of about 100 feet. They were hunting in Buenos Aires. And he shot at this buffalo. And I think the kind of buffalo it is not like our American Great Plains buffalo, but like a big water buffalo. He shot at it. He hit it. The animal did not like that. So the animal threw itself at him, charged him, and trampled him, and actually gored him. So he died. And he was part of a group of Mexicans who were hunting in Buenos Aires, and he happened to be the president of this hunting federation. And how did he die? He died in a hunting accident by being stampeded by this buffalo. So that's a sad story, but it's interesting when you think about the two ends of the spectrum. The lady in England who had to go to court because she wouldn't prevent the mice who were pests in her home and her neighbor's home, and this guy at the other end of the spectrum who's out there hunting big game for the very purpose of killing an animal for trophy or food, I guess. And may he rest in peace is all I can say. So, Cyrus, what are you telling me? So the British pound, so it's $1.10. That's the exchange rate.
That's right. And anyone wondering how much that buffalo weighed, it was 2,200 pounds.
Mm. So 1,000 kilos.
That's right.
I always get mildly irked. This is an honest admission here on my part. I get mildly irked when in the mainstream American press, I'm not talking about foreign press because they use the metric system over there, but a lot of people here, they're just pushing and pushing and pushing. They want to talk about kilometers and meters and kilos and all that. Nobody knows that stuff. And nobody cares about that stuff. I mean, unless you're a scientist, I understand. There are segments of society where if you're a pilot or an engineer or what have you, that understanding and using the metric system is preferable or good. I have no complaint about that. But the vast majority of Americans, we don't speak in terms of kilometers or meters or anything. And then they try to push it and push it and push it, and they don't translate it for the average person. Now, I have a quick, talk about a life hack. You just multiply it times 0.6 and you get a rough approximation, say in the case of a kilometer. Just multiply it times 0.6 and you have a rough approximation of how many miles that is. So I always convert it in my head. But so there's another life hack. 888-914-9149. I hope you're paying close attention, Cyrus. I've given you three thus far. We'll see if I can think of any more before we finish the show today. Let's go to Rod, waiting in Eureka, California. Good morning, Rod.
My question is, if the holy angels in heaven are going to be with God forever, and the evil angels, which are demons, are already damned in hell, how come we're going to be judging the angels in 1 Corinthians chapter 6? I'm just wondering if judge means actually the judge like we know it, or does it mean something else?
It seems to mean something else because we're reminded of this. Jesus himself said to the apostles that they would judge the angels. And I admit that is a mysterious statement that I'm not sure if I fully understand exactly what that entails. I've read some of the commentators who say that that will be a sign of human beings elevated to the level of angels in the life to come. And this, when the general judgment takes place and we receive our bodies back. So between now and then, as you know, Rod, we will be disembodied spirits. We'll be human, but we're not going to be fully human the way God created us. So when we receive our bodies back in the general resurrection, the blessed in heaven, at least some of these commentators, and by commentators, I'm referring to people like St. Thomas Aquinas. I'd have to go back to his treatise on angels to get the exact wording. But there is the thought that human beings will then become equal to the angels in the created order, and that our intellects will be super enhanced, etc. Now, I don't know if that's exactly what will happen, but maybe that's what this is referring to. But if the good angels are good angels, they have been ever since they passed their test, so they don't need any judgment from us. That's why I think that this enigmatic statement about judging the angels extends to something that doesn't mean that we sit in judgment over them and we make determinations about their fate, like you go up or you go down. That's already done. That's already happened. So I think what I would need to do, Rod, is to dig back into those commentaries and see what the really big people have to say about it. But off the top of my head, I'm pretty confident that it has nothing to do with judging angels in the sense of sentencing them for good or evil, because that's already been done a long time ago.
Okay, that's kind of what my thought was also. Mm-hmm. Are we going to be kind of elevated above angels then? Because we're going to be judging the world also.
Yeah, we're not going to be elevated above the angels. I don't see how that could be possible, because first of all, in the created order, angels are above us. And you can see a bit of this in Hebrews chapter 1. And so the main thing is that the angels by nature are superior to us. But here's what's interesting. Jesus in the incarnation did not become an angel. So God did not take to himself an angelic nature for our salvation. He took a lower nature, which is human nature. So now Jesus in the incarnation, God and man, is above the angels. And this is one of those interesting things to ponder, and that is that a lower order creature, aka human being, is now above even the highest angels. And this is true of Our Lady too. We recognize her as the queen of the angels. So there is something there, yes. And it does involve a progress that God wills for human beings to experience that would lift us at least to the level of the angels. And in the case of Jesus and Mary, higher than the angels. So these are things that I would need to do a bit more study on, Rod, but it's an interesting topic to be sure. Thank you. Let's go to Aaron now in Lakewood, California, not too far from LAX. Good morning, Aaron.
Yes, sir. Good morning, Mr. Madrid. I love the story of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and I've been reading it a lot recently.
Uh-huh.
I was wondering, because the thing that interests me the most is how the Aztecs were able to read into it. And I kind of see it like, I don't know if this is the right term, but kind of like a pagan typology, if you will, that kind of helped them accept our Lord and Catholicism. And so I was just wondering, because, I mean, I have, even like examples from my own culture as a Samoan, how it was easier. I was wondering if you had any like books or resources into that kind of topic.
I think I can help you with this. Now, if I understand your question as you're pertaining to the Aztecs, in other words, they understood something, even though it was confused and erroneous. They still understood the need for human the need for sacrifice to gods. Would that be the essence of?
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly. Yeah.
Okay. So here's how I would approach it. And forgive me, I'll have to be somewhat brief. Well, actually, you know what? Let's not do that. If you don't mind holding, I'll take a quick break and then I'll come right back to this question about what can we say, good, bad, or indifferent, about primitive cultures that practiced sacrifice. What does that mean? And is there any connection with Jesus? You might be surprised what my answer is. And we'll get to that, Aaron, on the other side of this quick timeout. So please stand by. The number to call, 888-914-9149. Coming right back right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio Line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/forester.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here
it's a good song. Hi, Patrick Madrid here. Thanks for listening to my podcast.
In today's crazy world, finding companies that align with your Catholic values is a challenge. Your choice of cell phone provider matters. Cyrus and I switched to Charity Mobile, and you should too. Enjoy excellent coverage on America's most reliable network while supporting a pro-life, pro-family company. Use offer code Patrick for a free phone. Don't miss out. Act now at charitymobile.com.
Steelers wheel. So Steelers wheel.
You approve?
I do.
All right. Yeah. I'll add it to
you
the
You know
list.
The song Baker Street by Jerry Rafferty?
I know I should. It's not.
It's got a great saxophone intro. Check it out sometime. Baker Street came out in the late 70s. Anyway, that's him. That's when his band, before he did his solo career, Jerry Rafferty, died of a heart attack some years ago. Really talented guy. Excellent, excellent talent. May he rest in peace. So, anyway, I have an email here. Short and sweet. And by the way, short and sweet wins the day. If you want to get your email on the air, we get so many of them. It's just a deluge, but I'm grateful for all of them. Thank you for taking time to write to me. And I'm always looking at your emails to see if there's something I can use on the air. But a life hack, if ever there were one for Relevant Radio, is if you want to have your email read on the air, the shorter and tighter and more to the point it is, the more likely I can read it. Like this one. This is from Bob listening in Milwaukee. He wrote in to me this morning saying, thank you, Patrick, for writing and sending me your new book, Inquisition. I recently received a copy, and I look forward to increasing my knowledge about our faith in the church. Thank you. Well, Bob, thank you. Kind of you to say so. And we are getting a lot of people posting pictures of it on social media. I'm seeing a lot of that now on Twitter. So maybe, Bob, that might be something for you to do. Not that people can get it anymore because the promotion is over. Nonetheless, it is always nice for us to see different people who have gotten their copies of the book. And I'm so glad that you received yours. Thank you. I have a note here from Jordan. He's listening in Minneapolis, and he says, Patrick, with all the life hacks you've been sharing this morning, could you perhaps be hinting to us listeners that your next book is going to be a book of life hacks? That's actually a great idea. I never, ever thought about that, Jordan, honestly, but that could be fun. I just don't know how quickly I would run out of life hacks. You don't want like a 5-page book, right?
Is that what your 50, what I learned in my first, I'm going to butcher the title, but you know what I'm talking about, what I learned in my first 50 years. But yes, life lessons.
Yeah. Well, not exactly. Life lessons, so the full title of that book is Life Lessons, 50 Things I Learned in My First 50 Years. And I wanted to do something that would be primarily autobiographical for my grandchildren, so that each of these chapters is a story about some crazy thing that happened in my life. And usually it's me making a stupid mistake, or I'm the butt of the joke. Some of them are kind of funny. Some are kind of sad, but along the way, I learned a lot of lessons. And so I thought it might be interesting for my grandchildren and great-grandchildren if they could know me, even if they don't know me personally, you know, many years from now when I'm gone. That way they would have something that they could say, oh, wow, he did this, or he did that, or this happened to him. So that was the motive behind writing that. But the idea of it, Cyrus, is not really life hacks. It's more like life lessons, as the title would suggest. And in a way, it's kind of like, don't make these mistakes that I made. Or isn't this a ridiculous situation I got myself into because I didn't do this or I should have done that? So in a way, maybe it is kind of a life hack book, I guess. I never thought of it that way.
Oh.
I assumed that you were in this conversation still, just by the look on your face.
Well, I was just thinking, the you know, Patrick Madrid made mistakes. What?
Oh, man.
I got to read this book.
Well, I hope you like it anyway. But you know what? Quite frankly, before we get back to the phones, one of the things that I'm able to draw upon in doing this program is the experience of making my own mistakes and in my own blunders. So here I am, this guy with a microphone, and presuming to give advice to other people. Now, other people call in and ask for it, so it's a fair exchange. I don't presume to sit in judgment of anybody, et cetera, but I have made plenty of my own mistakes. So I can draw upon that to say, here's a better way to go. Now, I haven't made mistakes in every category, at least I hope not, but I think making mistakes in life, that's what gives you experience. And if you have enough gray in your hair and you've lived long enough, you will indefinitely, no, that doesn't sound right. You will undoubtedly have made mistakes along the way. And then if you can repurpose that information to help other people. So like when I talk to my sons, you know, career advice or things about life, and they're all grown men now and they have families of their own. But as they were coming up through the ranks, Cyrus, I would try as best I could to impart to them, in fact, in some ways, things that I made mistakes on so that they could avoid that. And sometimes they took my advice, sometimes they didn't. But I have a feeling that as they give advice to their sons, who are now becoming young men, that they will be not only drawing upon their own experience, but also, here's what my dad told me, and I wish I had taken his advice. So I'm going to give you this advice, and we'll see what happens. So anyway, I got sidetracked. So thank you for the reminder. I'm coming back to you, Aaron, in Lakewood, California. Forgive the detour, but here we are. And you had asked about, you mentioned the word typology, which is interesting because that's a biblical word. When we think about things in the Old Testament that foreshadow something coming in the New Testament that's perfect by contrast. And you mentioned the Aztecs. And so just to recap it for people who maybe didn't hear the first part of what you were saying about how the Aztecs performed human sacrifice and it was dreadful and sinful. And yet, it seemed like it struck a nerve with you when I asked if you were asking about, I don't mean a nerve in a bad sense, it struck a chord with you when I mentioned that, is there some comparison here or connection between the Aztecs doing this human sacrifice and Jesus dying on the cross? Is that how you put it? Was that the direction we were going with that?
Right. That's really close because, or like, for example, my Samoan ancestors, they used to eat the hearts of their enemies. And it hit me one day. I was thinking about communion and how you take on the power of God when you're in a state of grace and how they took on the power they thought, right, you know?
Right. Well, this is a really important question, I think, and it's one that's very little talked about, and that is the innate human recognition not only of God, however the human being perceives of him. Some people worship the sun. Some people worshiped objects that they made by hand, idols. Some people worshiped many different gods that they saw controlling things like the hunt and the crops, fertility, war, love, and so on. I mean, so the whole pantheon of the Greek and the Roman gods, which are more or less the same gods, but with just interchangeable names, they were perceiving the world around them and seeing order and beauty and destruction, and certain things would happen on regular cycles, like the crops, spring, and in the seasons, etc. And so they ascribed to these forces of nature personification in the form of gods who controlled the sea or the sky or the underworld or things of that nature. So the first part of what I have to say on the topic, Aaron, is that it is an established fact that societies in every part of the world, doesn't matter where you go, and it doesn't matter how far back you go, we see evidence in up to the present day of people, each in their own way, recognizing that there is some higher power above them, which we would call God. And the second part is that they have this innate recognition that they are obliged in some way to worship that God. So how do we worship that God? Well, the most prevalent way in all of these various ancient societies is to offer sacrifice. We see it in Genesis. We see it, for example, in Genesis chapter 4, where Cain and Abel, what are they doing? They're offering sacrifice. So Cain is offering this, you know, chintzy sacrifice of vegetables and maybe throw in a few apples and whatnot. And there's really nothing great about that because that's easy to get and it's renewable. And his brother Abel, the just, he was sacrificing animals. And we see from that story, Aaron, that God accepted his sacrifice in part because, and I'm sure it ultimately had to do with the state of the two men's hearts, but it was also because the type of sacrifice he was offering was costly. It was the life of an animal, and that could have been used for meat or for clothing or what have you. So he's giving something better, something more valuable in sacrifice to God. God favors his sacrifice over Cain. Cain gets mad, kills Abel. You know the whole story. So we see this desire, this innate recognition that we should be offering some kind of sacrifice to whoever the God is up there. And you see it throughout all of history. So back to your point, I do indeed see a connection with the Aztecs, even though their motivation was wrong. Their desire to appease the gods as they understood them, the hummingbird wizard god, for example, and others, they were trying to manipulate those gods into not being harsh with them by offering them something of great value, the life of a living human being. Now, Jesus, of course, is the ultimate sacrifice because he is God who became man to die on the cross for our salvation. So he accomplishes what all these various pagan and Jewish sacrificial systems could only symbolize, like the Jewish system of sacrificing animals. There's constant sacrifice going on in the temple for centuries, and none of that really accomplished anything. It was all pointing toward Jesus. So in a way similar, Aaron, to like the Gilgamesh myth, which is an epic myth from Babylon, and it, like, for example, the indigenous tribes that the Jesuits in the 1600s encountered when they went into what is now upstate New York and southern Ontario, Canada, they encountered the various tribes of the Iroquois Federation, so the Algonquins and the Mohawks and the various tribes. And you know what astonished them is when they learned the languages of these people, they found out they knew all about the flood. They had never cracked open a Bible. They didn't know what that was. They never had any contact with, certainly not with Jews from the Old Testament era. So when the Jesuit fathers began to interact with them in their own language and began learning their own mythology, they discovered that these indigenous tribes, they knew about Adam and Eve. They didn't call them Adam and Eve, and the story was somewhat different, but it had to do with an original man and an original woman and being cast out of a previously perfect state. They knew all about that, and they knew all about the flood and all these other things that were astonishing to these Jesuits. So what they really bring forward, and I'll leave it at this, Aaron, because it's a long-winded answer, is that humanity has a collective memory of these biblical truths that we read about that go back so far into the mists of time, but this knowledge never left us. So the knowledge of the flood, some great flood that took place, this is something that's known even by primitive cultures all around the world. How do they know about that? Well, the answer seems to me is because it really happened. How do they know the Adam and Eve story, even if they have different details and slightly, you know, different versions of it? How do they know that? Well, because it really happened, and this knowledge was passed down. And in the same way, this recognition kind of built into our human minds that we have a duty of religion. That's what the word religion stems from, is our duty to offer praise and adoration to our Creator. And so each in their own way, they tried to do that. They would sacrifice animals, or they'd sacrifice people, or they would do whatever. And it was this realization that we all have, and it was perfected and finally revealed to us in its fullness in Jesus. So how's that for a long answer?
Wow, that was as beautiful. I have to listen to that again. I guess as a related fun fact too, the Japanese, I heard, they fell in love with the Latin Mass because it resembled even their own sacred tea ceremony. I mean, it's just, I guess typology, you're right, is not the word, but something like that.
It's not a bad word. Yeah, it's not a bad word. It actually is an apt term if we see it maybe from a broader perspective. No, it's a great thing. And do you know the story about the Catholic Church in Japan during the time of the shoguns, when the Catholic Church was utterly ruthlessly persecuted out of existence, or so they thought? Do you know that story?
Slightly.
Let me give you a brief overview, and this will be my parting gift, Aaron. Great call. Thank you. So at the time of St. Francis Xavier and the other missionary fathers, who were primarily Jesuits, who at the time of St. Ignatius of Loyola, the founder of the order, and he was dispatching these men all across the known world, and several of them, many of them, went to Asia. and they began to evangelize the peoples in China, in Korea, in Japan, in the Philippines, and elsewhere. And what happened was the Japanese people very quickly and readily embraced faith in Jesus Christ. And they, prior to that point, they were Shinto as a people. And Shinto primarily has to do, Shintoism primarily has to do with ancestor worship. But in any case, Buddhism and Shintoism were the religious ideals of Japan at that time. But they very quickly embraced faith in Jesus, and they were baptized, and they were converted. And this became alarming to the shoguns, the military political leaders in Japan at the time, so much so that because they feared that this was a form of Western colonization of Japan, because more and more and more and more Japanese folk were becoming Catholic, they shut it down really hard. So it coincided with a shutdown of Japan to commerce and trade with Western countries. For the most part, that ended too. They didn't want to have a lot of foreigners running around in Japan. But there was an especially repressive persecution of Catholics, and it was terrible. The things they did to these Catholic men, women, boys, and girls who would not renounce their faith in Jesus were just the stuff of legends. But it's not a legend. It all really happened. So for, and I'd have to go back and look at the timeline, but at least like 300 years went by, and there was no church because it was outlawed. And then when Catholic missionaries were finally permitted, and I think this might have been under the Meiji emperorship, I think that Emperor Meiji allowed Westerners to come back in again. And so eventually, Catholic priests went back to Japan. But the Protestant ministers had been there for years and years before that. So I don't really know the whys and wherefores, but the Protestant ministers had gone back earlier, and they were evangelizing the people and not making a whole lot of progress. So there's this documented story that took place where this delegation of Catholic priests went back to Japan and resumed contact with the people. And much to their shock, to their great surprise, they discovered that there were a lot of Catholics there. And they asked them, well, what do you mean you're Catholic? Because they were practicing the faith privately, secretly, and for many generations, they had preserved the Catholic faith faithfully underground under threat of persecution. And the priest said, well, how can this be? And they said, well, we've had the sacraments of baptism and holy matrimony. So they didn't have the Eucharist. They didn't have confession. They couldn't get confirmed because there were no priests at that time. But they maintained their faith in Jesus, and they maintained the visible presence of the church among these Catholic folk who were, in essence, living underground, not literally. And so the priest said, well, that's astonishing. How did you know to come talk to us? Because after all, the Protestant missionaries have been there for years before we got back here. And they said, well, our ancestors told us that when the time comes, when the priests come back, here's how you'll know them. Number one, they will not be married. They'll be celibate. And the British the ministers, the Protestant ministers, are married typically. And the second way that we'll know that it's really you is that you'll have a devotion to Mary. And they told these people hundreds of years earlier, when they finally come back, this is how you'll know them. And so, much to their great happiness, they discovered that there was a small but thriving Catholic community that had endured that very long winter under persecution. Now, sadly, the efforts were interrupted such that if they hadn't been interrupted by the shoguns, it's entirely possible that Japan and maybe even China and perhaps even Korea would have been like the Philippines, where it would have been overwhelmingly Catholic. And yet it didn't happen that way. So there's a little slice of history, and there's much more to it, much more in the way of precise details, but that's kind of a sketchy overview. Or no, that didn't sound right. That's a sketch. Not sketchy. It's a sketch. I'll be right back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
Welcome back to the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
Hey, welcome back. Thanks for listening. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We'll get you on the air. If you have a need of a second opinion, maybe, or you'd like some advice, give me a shout. 888-914-9149. Let's go now to, you know what, before we do that, real quick, I just want to mention, there's still time for you to sign up for the drawing to get the beautiful hand-painted large nativity set that you can put in your front yard, or you could put on your porch, or put in your front window, or just have inside the house to evangelize the kiddos. But it's really beautiful. It's made available to us by a generous benefactor, and we have 200 of these free sets to give away. No cost to you. You don't pay for anything. And all you have to do is go sign up. So the window is closing, and as of you got 48 hours, roughly, maybe a little bit more than that. But in about 48 hours at midnight on October 16th, midnight central, the window will close, and you'll no longer be able to sign up for this. So if you want to be in the running to be one of the lucky 200, go to relevantradio.com/set, and there you will see an image of this beautiful nativity set. Go to relevantradio.com/set, and you can register, and you just might be one of the ones who gets that for free. So check it out. Let's go to Sarah now in Shreveport. Good morning, Sarah.
Good morning, Patrick. I have a question for you regarding the Day of the Dead. My daughter is in high school. She attends a Catholic school, and her Spanish class is doing they're putting together an altar for the Day of the Dead. And I am not okay with that. My daughter has come back to me with, it's part of the culture, and that's what we're trying to learn. My response was, gosh, there's so many wonderful Catholic priests that contributed to the culture. Why can't we focus on those? But am I wrong? And one, should I have a conversation with the school?
Is it a Catholic school or a public school?
It's Catholic.
Okay. Well,
it's a high school.
Yeah. By way of context, if nothing else, my father's side of the family is all Mexican, with, of course, Spanish in there as well, because Mexicans came originally from Spain. So there's a lot of that going on, too. But from the standpoint of somebody who grew up not in that culture, because I grew up in Southern California, I didn't grow up in Mexico, but my family has deep, deep roots in Mexico. And so although we never practiced this custom of Dia de los Muertos, we never did this bringing of food and drinks and lighting candles and things like that, at kind of making a little shrine at a cemetery. We never did any of those things because it was always taught to us that that is superstitious. And it's really, the problem ultimately is that it's a form of syncretism. Syncretism is the mixing of, in this case, pagan ideas about ancestors and offering these libations and food things to help them or to please them. And that's not really compatible with Christianity. So it's an unhealthy, improper mixture of pagan elements with Christian elements. And I understand it's very much part of the culture, but it's not something that the church herself says, hey, practice Dia de los Muertos. We do have that feast day. So we have All Saints Day on November 1st and All Souls Day on November 2nd. And this is actually a permutation of that. So as the simple folk, the peasant folk, began to, you know, and we're going back many centuries here, the Catholic custom of praying for the dead on All Souls Day and those masses and other things associated with that, not to mention beautifying people's graves and coming back to the grave to pay your respects and pray for them. That's all very Catholic, no doubt about it. But then over time, this got mixed in with it. So now Dia de los Muertos it's not something that we should be attentive to, because it is now going in a direction that's contrary to the faith. And what I mean by that is this. you can't, well, okay, let me put it this way. The common understanding of Dia de los Muertos is that these dead relatives can come back to that place. They can come back to where you've put the food and the, you know, the coffee or the wine or whatever you're putting there and the candles, and that these things are not only a commemoration of them, they are a commemoration of them, just like you might put flowers on a grave, but that there's this sense that the dead can actually be there and either communicate with you or at least be there and be pleased by what you're doing with these ofrendas, with the altars and the food and all these other things. That's not Catholic. And so that can lead people into a kind of folk superstition that is not healthy. It pulls people away from their true focus, which of course is God. So that's my concern there. I understand it's deeply ingrained in Mexican culture. I totally understand it. And I think I understand the reasons why it's become so deeply ingrained. But it's something that I would encourage people not to participate in for that reason. Now, as far as the school is concerned, I'm not sure how far you're going to get with that. Chances are they're going to just pat you on the head and say, well, if you don't want your daughter to participate, then she can be out of the classroom, but the rest of us are going to do it. I don't foresee that right. They're likely to just roll over and say, okay, we won't do it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm sure you're right. It's just another little thing that's irritating to pay money for a Catholic school where they would rather focus on secularism rather than informing our children on the beauty of our faith. And it so happens that, of course, November 1st and 2nd is when this altar is going to be put up. My daughter did ask if it was okay if she put an altar that, you know, depicted the saints.
That would be good. Would they let her do that in the classroom?
So I'm not quite sure. I'm going to go and talk with the principal, I think, in that regard. Like she's come up with a solution, a Catholic solution, and I want her to see that my hope is that she can go ahead and show students the Catholic side. I mean, the majority of the students that attend are Protestant in our area, but I think it confuses children when we introduce the pagan side or the secular side of the world, and we forget about the Catholic side, the beautiful side. Uh-huh. So anyway, it seems like you and I are on the same page. But yes, thank you. I'm going to play this back for my daughter to hear, because you used quite a few words that I also used. You said it much better than I did. So I think she'll get a lot out of that.
What grade is she in,
so thank
Sarah?
You. She's a junior. She's okay. A junior. We had the same conversation when she was a freshman. And so the school's going to, I mean, they already heard from me before, but they'll just hear from me again.
And they're probably thinking, oh, there goes Sarah again. This is the
Here
latest thing now.
Here she comes. But at least we're coming with an alternative, and it's not my alternative. It's my daughter's alternative.
Yeah. There
you go. I think that might be good for her.
And I want to add something I didn't say earlier. Mm-hmm. I don't suspect the motives of any of our Mexican family and friends who do that. I don't look at them and say, you're doing something evil and you know it. I wouldn't say that to them. I think this is something it's considered harmless, and it's considered something good and loving to remember your dead relatives and to be thinking about. That's all good. So I don't want to give the impression that Dia de los Muertos doesn't have some good to it. It does. That's what makes it problematic, is that you've got some really good elements to it, but you've got the stuff that's not good that's mixed in, and that's where it becomes problematic.
Right.
So,
right. And that was the part of our conversation on the drive home yesterday, was that we do pray for our dead. We do think about our dead. We do go into the cemetery. We do these things, but we don't want them to come back to us. We want them in heaven. We don't want them here.
Yeah. Yeah.
That part about it is upsetting. And like I had mentioned, you know, we're in a Catholic school, which is predominantly Protestant, who in our area have a very warped sense of the Catholic faith. Introducing something like this, I think, just muddies the waters even more for our mm-hmm. non-Catholic friends. And so it's just, mm-hmm. I just see so many problems instead of enlightening our children in the beauty and the rituals of our faith that have those great meanings. It's all good things. Let's leave yeah. the pagan side aside.
You know, an analogy to this or a related thing to this is the way, for example, at Catholic festivals, and I saw a lot of this in Southern California growing up, but it really, you didn't really see it until maybe more like in the 90s or 2000s. I don't remember seeing it before that, but where they would involve like Aztec, the descendants of the Aztec tribe in Mexico, in dancing and mm-hmm. other things like that. So I can use that as a brief comparison here. There's nothing wrong at all with employing or enjoying or featuring the cultural heritage of the people, because after all, these people were the ones who responded to the apparition of Our Lady of Guadalupe, and they, you know, 11 million of them converted. So they have a very important place, of perhaps the most important place in that story of Mexico and the conversion of the people. So there's nothing wrong at all with wanting to feature the beauty of their culture, etc. But yeah. when it starts drifting into religious rites and dances and other rituals mm-hmm. that are religious, that's where we really should draw the line, because that is what was vanquished. The, you know, mm-hmm. the horrible human sacrifices and all those things. So we have to, as the Bible says, maybe we could leave it at this, Sarah, test all things and hold fast to that which is good. I think that's a great rule of thumb. Thank you, Sarah. I'm coming right back right after this.